Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 21st, 2025 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week shows a steam locomotive barreling down the tracks. It's coming to a street crossing. Black smoke billowing out of the stack, smokestack. And driving the train is President Donald Trump. He's leaning out of the engineer's window, his tie's flying back in the air. And standing on the other side of the road he's about to cross is a judge in his black robe. He's got his hand held up in a stop signal. The headline is Collision Course, How Trump's Showdown with the Courts Could Spark a Constitutional Crisis. That is our first main story. We'll start there. Trump allies rage at courts amid judicial pushback. What happened? Legal experts warned that America was headed toward a constitutional crisis this week as the Trump administration failed to comply with at least two court judgments, and Vice President J.D. Vance argued that judges have no authority to restrain executive power. President Trump's flurry of sweeping executive orders has led state attorneys general, labor unions, and other groups to file more than 50 lawsuits, yielding numerous judgments against the administration. Judges have issued temporary blocks on a buyout program for federal workers, the forced leave of thousands of USAID employees, access to government payment systems by a member of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, and an executive order to end birthright citizenship. But a federal judge said that the administration was openly defying his clear and unambiguous order to unfreeze billions of dollars in federal assistance, and U.S. aid workers filed a complaint that they had not been reinstated as ordered. White House spokesman Harrison Fields said the administration's actions have been completely lawful. Musk called for the impeachment of Manhattan-based U.S. District Judge Paul A. Engelmeyer, who barred DOGE staffers from accessing sensitive Treasury records, and posted on X that radical left activists posing as judges are staging a coup. Vance wrote on X that judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Meanwhile, Trump accused courts of trying to stop us from looking for corruption, adding, "Maybe we have to look at the judges." Amid the legal wrangling, the administration ramped up its offensive against the federal bureaucracy. It shuttered the office of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and sidelined its staff, and cut $900 million from a Department of Education agency that tracks student progress and educational best practices. Trump signed an executive order directing agency officials to draft plans for large-scale staff reductions and mandating that future hires be made in conjunction with a DOGE team lead. "The goal is to restore democracy," said Musk at an Oval Office signing. "If the bureaucracy is in charge, then what meaning does democracy actually have?" What the editorial said. "Well, that was fast," said the Wall Street Journal. Just 3 weeks into Trump presidency, and the doomsayers who warned he'd be a dictator now say a constitutional crisis has arrived. Ignore them. Most of Trump's actions rest on strong legal ground. With others, he is testing legal boundaries, aiming to tee up Supreme Court rulings he hopes will go his way. That's no crisis. It's just what President Joe Biden did when he exceeded his power by canceling student loans and banning evictions. But unlike Biden, who found new ways to push through loan write-offs, Trump has said he will always abide by the courts. Believe that at America's peril, said the St. Louis Dispatch. Trump is a constitutional bulldozer who's running roughshod over a compliant Congress. That leaves the courts as the only effective backstop blocking Trump's plainly unconstitutional moves. But the court's power is reliant on universal respect for judicial review, and Trump, Musk, and Vance are signaling they don't intend to play by the rules. What the columnist said. It's not hyperbole anymore, said Josh Marshall in Talking Points memo. Musk is in charge of the U.S. government. He loomed over his boss this week as Trump signed an order putting DOGE commissars in charge of personnel decisions at every federal agency, effectively giving Musk authority over the entire structure of the U.S. government. Three cheers for that, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. It's thrilling to see an administration finally targeting federal waste and fraud. Democrats are howling about overreach, but this is exactly what Americans voted for. It's also blatantly illegal, said former White House counsel Alan Charles Rawl in the Washington Post. The Constitution is clear. Agencies and programs created by statute can't be killed or transformed without Congress approval. The radical overhaul underway isn't just testing boundaries. It's shattering the fundamental checks and balances of our constitutional order. If Congress won't stop it, the Supreme Court must. They won't if Vance has any say, said Ian Ward in Politico. Over the years, he's made repeated claims for executive supremacy and said a reelected Trump should defy judges who stand in his way. If the Supreme Court were to block a government overhaul, he said in 2021, Trump should stand before the country like President Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. It's possible cooler heads will prevail, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic, but with Trump's every step towards authoritarianism meeting GOP acquiescence, it'd be no surprise to see him take the next one. We may be sleepwalking into a constitutional crisis. We're already there, said Amber Phillips in The Washington Post. So say experts who've watched in horror as Trump has fired watchdogs, steamrolled Congress, and otherwise cast off any restraint. There are few guardrails left, and as bad as things are now, a move to buck court orders would be an alarming escalation. We're looking into an abyss where the premise of the rule of law may be rejected, said Ben Ratterstorff of the nonpartisan Protect Democracy Group. That's where things get really scary. Controversy of the week is USAID, the end of American soft power. And just like that, the world's greatest humanitarian country has become one of its least, said Mona Shirin in The Bulwark. At the behest of President Trump, Elon Musk, the world's richest man and head of Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, entered the headquarters of the U.S. Agency for International Development earlier this month and began, in his own gleeful words, feeding U.S. aid into the wood chipper. In a matter of days, Musk's Doge gang had taken down U.S. aid's website, put nearly all the agency's 10,000 workers on leave, and halted the flow of aid to the most vulnerable people on Earth. No one denies there's wasteful spending in government, said Bill Press in The Hill, but U.S. aid delivered taxpayers more bang for our buck than any other government program. It has saved millions of lives at a cost of about $40 billion a year, less than 1% of the federal budget. USAID funds HIV/AIDS treatments in Africa, landmine clearance in Cambodia, emergency housing in Ukraine, and much more, Russia and China will quickly fill the soft power vacuum left by the agency's demise, making this one of the most short-sighted and stupid decisions by any modern president. Gutting U.S. aid might sound heinous, said Nicole Russell in USA Today, but it must be done. Voters elected Trump to put America first. With U.S. families struggling with inflation and the federal deficit hitting a whopping $1.8 trillion last year, it's hard to justify U.S. aid spending $53 million on climate-resilient activities in developing world cities. Then there's the $400 million digital technology project for LGBTQ people in Africa, said National Review in an editorial. But the problem isn't just a handful of programs. It's that U.S. aid has strayed from its founding mission of using aid to promote capitalism and political liberty, and has become focused on the twin obsessions of climate change and DEI. Trump has given Secretary of State Marco Rubio responsibility for the agency. Now he must turn it into an international development assistance system that truly advances America's interest. Trump may have miscalculated, said Nick Cottagio in The Dispatch. Yes, Americans are opposed to foreign aid in principle. 69% said we spend too much in a 2023 poll. But they'll get queasy when they see the human toll of this pullback. Treatment for HIV-positive infants in Uganda has been halted. Medical trial participants in South Africa have been abandoned with experimental devices still in their bodies. And Sudanese children are being left to starve. About $2 billion worth of American food aid is grown here in the U.S., said Daniel Wu in the Washington Post. Now hundreds of thousands of tons of that food is rotting in warehouses. And U.S. farmers who once supplied the government are stuck in limbo. All true, said Roy Texier in the Free Press, but it's political suicide for Democrats to rush to U.S. aid's defense. The legality of DOGE's work is at best unclear. It's Congress's job, not the president's, to regulate agencies and authorize spending. While the courts untangle the mess, Democrats should keep their powder dry, not confirm their reputation as foreigner-coddling champions of bureaucracy. Democrats shouldn't defend U.S. aid as an institution, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark, but they should flood social media with the faces and stories of the actual people who are going to die because a president entrusted their fates to a ketamine-addled billionaire and his menagerie of 20-year-old incels. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for self-deportation. After new data revealed that a record number of Americans applied for Irish citizenship and passports following Donald Trump's election win, Erin Clayton, an applicant in New Hampshire, said she figured a second passport would be smart to have, just in case. It's a good week for surprise guests. After a woman vacationing at a beachfront hotel in the Netherlands returned to her room to find a gray ocean seal sleeping on the floor. At first, the seal was completely relaxed, said wildlife rescue workers, but it became quite grumpy once awoken. It was a good week for tradition. After the Church of England's ruling body ruled that, no, the church will not offer wheat-free wafers and non-alcoholic wine as part of its Eucharist ritual, Bishop of Lichfield, Michael Ipgrave, assured non-drinking, gluten-eschewing believers that they can still be partakers by faith of the body and blood of Christ. But it was a bad week for literalism. After a doctor in Italy was placed under investigation for using hospital equipment to give his injured cat a CAT scan before successfully operating on the feline, she was between life and death, an unapologetic Gianluca Fennell said of his pet, Athena. I knew I could only save her with a quick intervention. It was a bad week for stiff upper lips. After England's Earl of Yarmouth sued his parents for the trauma of having not inherited the family's 6,000-acre, $105 million estate on his 30th birthday. William Seymour said the news upended his life and forced him to seek professional help and counseling. And it was a bad week for curiosity after Sri Lankan officials blamed a nationwide power cut on a macaque who came into contact with our grid transformer at a power station south of Colombo. Electricity was soon restored to Sri Lanka's 22 million residents. There's no word on the monkey's condition. In other news, Trump halts enforcement of anti-bribery law. President Trump this week signed an executive order instructing the Justice Department to stop enforcing a law designed to limit corruption in multinational companies. The 1977 Foreign Corrupt Practices Act bans companies operating in the U.S. from paying foreign officials to secure business deals. There were about 30 criminal enforcement actions under the law last year. The executive order prohibits federal authorities from using the act to launch new investigations or enforce new actions for 180 days. Trump has long argued that the act makes foreign companies hesitant to do business with Americans for fear of legal action, and he believes it may have hurt his plans to build a hotel in Azerbaijan over a decade ago. It sounds good, he said of the act, but it hurts the country. Many of the companies that have paid fines under the act were foreign multinationals, including European firms Airbus and Siemens. And the briefing, Panama's troubled waters. President Trump has vowed to take back the U.S.-built Panama Canal. Is that in America's interest? How important is the canal to the U.S.? A former symbol of American imperialism, the 51-mile man-made channel linking the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans remains critical to the U.S.'s economy and security. The canal today handles about 5% of the world's seaborne trade and 40% of all U.S. container traffic. An annual $270 billion in cargo passes through it. Before the U.S.-built canal was completed in 1914, a ship sailing from New York to San Francisco had to go around the southern tip of South America, a dangerous journey that could take months. The canal reduced that trip to weeks. Today, it takes 11 days, allowing the U.S. to flex its naval and commercial might around the world. The waterway linked America's growing Pacific power to more traditional Atlantic relationships, said Richard Feinberg, a professor of international political economy at the University of California, San Diego. President Trump now wants the U.S. to again control and operate the canal, just as it did for the waterway's first 85 years. Saying the 1977 deal that ceded the canal to Panama was a foolish gift. How did the U.S. come to build the canal? The tale begins in 1903 when Panama, then part of Colombia, declared its independence. It got an assist from President Theodore Roosevelt, who recognized the breakaway nation and sent U.S. warships to protect it. In return, Roosevelt secured a treaty that, for $10 million, gave the U.S. the right to build the waterway plus control of a canal zone extending 5 miles on either side. Cutting a path through Panama's mountains, swamps, and dense jungle was a staggering effort that took 10 years and cost the lives of more than 5,600 workers, most of them Afro-Caribbean. The canal was regarded as a wonder of engineering when it opened. But in the following decades, local resentment grew over the 553 square mile canal zone, which was off limits to ordinary Panamanians. This was the most valuable piece of land in the country, said Ovidio Diaz Espino, an expert on the canal's history, and it was being exploited by somebody else. Tensions set a boil in January 1964 when anti-U.S. rioting broke out. 21 Panamanians and 4 U.S. soldiers were killed. The U.S. and Panama began negotiations on the canal's ownership, talks that concluded with the 1977 signing of two treaties by President Jimmy Carter. What was agreed? One treaty stated that the U.S. would gradually transfer canal ownership to Panama, with a handover being completed on December 31, 1999. The other mandated that Panama would charge just, reasonable, and equitable canal transit fees and allow U.S. military to combat any threat to its neutral operation. The treaties held even after President George H.W. Bush sent U.S. troops into Panama in 1989 to remove strongman leader General Manuel Noriega. But Trump now claims Panama has violated the neutrality treaty. He says it is overcharging U.S. ships, even though all ships are charged by a set formula based on size, cargo, and other factors. In his inaugural address, he claimed that China is operating the canal, and so we're taking it back. He has since refused to rule out a military intervention. Are the Chinese running the canal? Panamanian President Jose Raul Mulino calls the claim nonsense, noting there is not a single Chinese soldier in the canal, for the love of God. Still, concern is rising in Washington about Beijing's growing presence in the region. In 2017, Panama became the first Latin American nation to join China's Belt and Road Initiative. China is now backing infrastructure projects there, including a canal bridge, a railway line, and a cruise ship terminal. The primary concern, though, is the Hong Kong-based companies that operate 2 of 5 ports adjacent to the canal, one on each end. Beijing could use those facilities to gather data on canal traffic or to host Chinese military assets. A foreign power today possesses, through their companies, which we know are not independent, the ability to turn the canal into a choke point, said Secretary of State Marco Rubio. How has Panama responded to Trump's threats? Mulino insists a return of the waterway is out of the question. Every square meter of the Panama Canal and its adjacent zone area belongs to Panama, he said. Trump's words have stirred outrage and anxiety among Panamanians. Hundreds protested Rubio's visit to Panama City this month, and some burned images of Rubio and Trump. But the tiny country, which has no army, could offer no meaningful resistance if Trump decided to use force to grab the canal. All he needs is to land 10,000 troops, and that's it, said Diaz Espino. Would Trump do that? Few experts expect Trump to try to seize the canal. More likely, he is angling for more favorable terms or U.S. investment opportunities. Fees have risen sharply in recent years, due in part to drought conditions that have lowered the canal's capacity. But it's not clear what any concessions might look like. Mulino announced last week that his country will lead the Belt and Road Initiative, and the State Department claimed Panama would allow U.S. Navy ships to pass through for free, a claim Mulino blasted as false and Rubio quickly walked back. It hints at one possible concession, but the $13 million the Defense Department pays in fees is dust compared with the $850 billion budget, said Trump's former Panama Ambassador John Feeley. By offering the U.S. favorable terms, Panama would also violate the 1977 treaties, which guarantees equal treatment for all canal users. And Trump's public stance remains that nothing short of full U.S. control will do. "We're taking it back," he said, "or something very powerful is going to happen." Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Cheap eggs raise the risk of a pandemic. "Insisting on cheaper eggs is a huge mistake," said Jan Dukowicz. "The outbreak of H5N1, aka bird flu, has killed nearly 150 million chickens in the U.S. and made egg prices surge by 50% over the past year." On the campaign trail, Donald Trump used egg prices as a proxy for inflation and promised to bring them down. But the problem with making eggs cheap again is that cheap eggs created this problem in the first place. Egg prices are kept low by the ruthless efficiency of factory farms, which produce virtually all of the 110 billion eggs Americans eat annually. On these farms, giant sheds house more than 100,000 chickens who live in such cramped cages they can't spread their wings. Such tight quarters make factory farms hotbeds of disease. Public health experts have warned for decades that these practices can be incubators of viral diseases that jump species and turn into pandemics. Already, bird flu has infected 67 Americans and killed one last month, and has now spread to dairy cows. To prevent another pandemic, we must reduce reliance on foods that are likely vectors of disease. Oatmeal is still a very affordable way to start the day. Why men can't find a spouse. The national marriage rate is hovering at an all-time low, said Derek Thompson, and adult relationships are in trouble. For the first time since at least the 1970s, women under 35 are more likely to share a household with their parents than with a romantic partner. The problem is especially glaring among lower-income Americans. Since the 1980s, coupling has declined more than twice as fast among Americans without a college degree compared with college graduates. There are several factors, but the most important is simple. Many young men are falling behind economically. While women have charged into the workforce and seen their college graduation rates soar, the earnings of non-college educated men at age 45 have dropped by nearly 25% over the past 50 years. For women, marriage has traditionally served as a form of insurance against the threat of violence, the risk of poverty. Young men with low incomes and dim future prospects for advancement make for less attractive partners. And in the modern world, women do not feel obligated to marry them or to have children. As the economic and cultural trajectories of men and women move in opposite directions, the sexes drift apart. This column comes from India. Taking back our tired, our poor. India has always been proud of our diaspora, said Sanjayu Baru. So many Indians have succeeded abroad as business leaders, engineers, and entrepreneurs, living advertisements of all India has to offer. But the 100 or so forlorn Indian migrants who were deported from the U.S. last week are ambassadors of a different kind. They remind the world not of Indian talent and enterprise, culture and civilization, but of the discrimination and hardship that led so many of us to emigrate. In the past 5 years, as many as 170,000 Indians have been detained trying to enter the U.S. illegally. They are the underclass, the modern-day version of the poor of British India, who became indentured laborers over a century ago. Under President Trump's new mass deportation order, they are now being kicked out. Trump has openly said that he's happy to take in our IT workers and offer them H-1B visas, but the huddled masses who have only their manual labor to offer are not welcome. And it's not just the U.S. Everywhere, India's talented and wealthy are being welcomed, while our depressed and desperate are being shunned. The truly shameful thing is that we too treat our migrants with contempt when they return. Kicked out by the land of opportunity, will they find any opportunity here? The last word, our in-depth article, betrayal in Doral, Venezuela. Many Venezuelans in Florida thought Donald Trump would protect them from deportation, said Sabrina Rodriguez and Reshma Kirpalani in the Washington Post. They were wrong. Doral, Florida. Ronald Bellorin decided to flee Venezuela for the United States during President Donald Trump's first administration, convinced the Republican leader would protect people like him who had been targeted by an autocratic regime. Now the university professor is worried the Trump administration is going to deport him. The Department of Homeland Security has canceled the temporary protected status given to thousands of Venezuelans who have arrived in recent years. Bellerin's permission to work in the United States is set to expire in April and is shielded from deportation in September. Today I feel the same way I felt in Venezuela, that they're going to come take me somewhere I won't be able to escape from, Bellerin said, tearing up as he described his family's ordeal. It's terrible to feel this way here in the United States. He paused for a moment to compose himself. I thought we would be safe here. The decision to cancel temporary protected status, TPS, for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans has ignited fear, confusion, and outrage in this Miami suburb, which is affectionately known as Doralzuela. Venezuelans here have been some of Trump's biggest proponents. Even if many could not vote, they attended rallies, decorated their front lawns with Trump flags, and took to social media to support the man they thought would prioritize removing Nicolas Maduro from power. For many Venezuelans, Trump's decision feels like betrayal. The Venezuelan community gave President Trump their support, said John de la Vega, a Venezuelan-American immigration lawyer and Army veteran. This is completely different of what I thought it was going to be. Perhaps nowhere have Venezuelans put down roots as firmly in the United States as in Doral. Children born in Venezuela or to Venezuelan parents in the United States fill the city's schools. Family-owned restaurants that shuttered in Caracas have reopened in strip malls. Many business owners, lawyers, and doctors have now been here so long that they have reestablished professional careers, purchased homes, and built the suburb into one of Miami's fastest-growing communities. The city is also home to a Trump golf course and resort, and the president visited Doral often during his first term and while campaigning to meet with community leaders and boast of his fight against the Maduro regime. Some of Trump's most dramatic inroads with Latino voters were made in Doral, where roughly 40% of the city's residents have Venezuelan roots. He went from losing the city in 2016 to narrowly winning in 2020. In the 2024 election, he won 62% of the vote in Doral, beating Vice President Kamala Harris by 25 percentage points, according to an analysis of the Miami-Dade County precinct data. Andrea Gabriela Rangel Walter, 29, is among those who thought Trump would shield Venezuelans from deportation. She said the overwhelming majority of her friends and family supported Trump, including her father, who is now at risk of being removed from the country His TPS expires in April. She knew Trump had vowed to deport immigrants who committed crimes and singled out members of the Venezuelans' feared Tren de Aragua gang as initial targets. That was something she agreed with and welcomed. But she didn't expect Trump to conflate criminals with Venezuelans like her parents and younger brother. He's been to Doral. He's been to Miami, she said between bites of an empanada at a small Venezuelan restaurant. He knows all Venezuelans aren't Tren de Aragua. Ranger Walter pointed to Venezuelans' contributions to South Florida. Visit any business, whether it's an office, hotel, or store, and there are Venezuelans working inside. New shopping centers and apartment complexes are being built to meet the demand of new residents, many Venezuelan, who have moved in. Esto es Doralzuela, she said, referring to the city's nickname. This is Doralzuela. Ranger Walter, a U.S. resident, said her husband, who is Venezuelan and a U.S. citizen, voted for Harris and now chides her father for his support of Trump. My husband told my father, Tú quieres votar por Trump y mira ahora él te está votando, she said. You wanted to vote for Trump and now he's kicking you out. Her father was blindsided by Trump's decision to eliminate TPS for Venezuelans, but Ranger Walter said she still supports the president. He says that Trump is doing right by his country, that we did invade his country, and he's defending it, she said. Her parents are now going to apply for political asylum, a process she said they didn't start before because of how costly it can be. Ranger Walter's hope is that a pending asylum case will allow them to remain in the United States until she becomes a U.S. citizen next year and can try to claim them. She looked over at another table and noticed a stack of flyers for a prominent local immigration lawyer. That's actually who I think they're going to go with, she said. That same lawyer has a large billboard at a major intersection in Doral, advertising its firm's work on asylum claims. Mid-conversation, Ranger Walter paused to listen in as a man chatted with workers preparing orders behind a counter. The customer, also Venezuelan, said Trump had turned his back on the community that lifted him up. Es más falso que un billete de mil. He's more fake than a $1,000 bill. You see, she said, everyone is in shock. Immigration lawyers like De La Vega said they have been inundated with calls and emails from nervous immigrants. Some are parents asking if it is safe to go to work and send their kids to school. Others want to know if they should apply for asylum and whether they could be deported. De La Vega was shocked by the decision to rescind temporary protected status for Venezuelans. The initial notice from DHS applies to approximately 350,000 Venezuelans. But in total, about 600,000 are recipients of the protections, which President Joe Biden first extended to them in 2021 and again in 2023. Venezuelans are by far the largest group protected from deportation under a 1990 law that authorizes the government to award undocumented immigrants TPS if their countries are experiencing war, disaster, or another crisis. De La Vega's dismay turned into anger when he read Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem's termination notice. In it, she argued that Venezuelans no longer needed protection, in part because there had been notable improvements in several areas such as the economy, public health, and crime. Trump knows exactly what's going on in Venezuela, and these actions and these reports that they're filing are completely inconsistent with the reality, he said. Was America First policy then for us to send innocent people back to a regime? Is that what we do? De La Vega warned that Trump and Republicans will suffer at the ballot box. Many TPS holders have U.S. citizen relatives who can vote. He said the decision will influence how he votes in the midterms and the next presidential election. There's a lot of people here saying, hey, we gave you this. This is our gift to you, our vote, he said. And then you do all this stuff. Not everyone is as surprised. Samir Luzardo had been growing concerned as Trump ramped up his rhetoric against Venezuelans on the campaign trail. The Republican candidate spoke frequently of an invasion and mentioned Tren de Aragua gang members as if they were everywhere. It reminded Luzardo of Trump's description of Mexican immigrants during his 2015 presidential campaign, in which he alleged they were bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. We're the new target, said Luzardo, 55, an independent journalist. Luzardo once served on Venezuela's equivalent of the Federal Communications Commission, but he said his efforts to fight government censorship made him a target. He said he decided to flee with his family in 2016 after regime officials began threatening his son. He has been waiting 9 years for his asylum case to be heard. When Luzardo received TPS in 2021, he felt some relief, he said. Now he is worried about whether his family will be able to stay. Going back to Venezuela, he said, is not an option. And he is alarmed by Trump's initial gestures toward the Maduro regime. The president sent his special missions envoy, Richard Grenell, to meet with Maduro in Caracas in late January. The two reached an agreement for Venezuela to accept deportees and release hostages. The Trump administration did not address last year's presidential election in Venezuela, widely considered fraudulent, or Maduro's arrest of more than 1,700 political prisoners in recent months in its communications about the meeting. A photo of a Trump envoy shaking hands with Maduro in the middle of Miraflores presidential palace, all smiling, it gives legitimacy to an illegitimate government, Luzardo said, shaking his head. The journalist said that most Venezuelans, if not all, want to go home, but under the right circumstances. Beloren, the university professor who fled in 2018, said he never wanted to leave his home country. He loved his career teaching electronic technology at the University of Orient and couldn't imagine a life away from Puerto La Cruz, a port city surrounded by beaches. Though he had long been outspoken against the country's leftist leadership, he said he didn't feel his life was in danger until Maduro became president and empowered gangs and regime supporters to go after the opposition. Beloren applied for political asylum when he arrived in Miami. The process can take years, so he registered for temporary protected status as well in 2021. The U.S. government denied his asylum claim in 2023, saying that while his testimony was found credible, the events you described and the harm you fear are not serious enough to rise to the level of persecution, according to court documents he shared. On a recent morning, he rushed to El Arepazo, a widely known Venezuelan restaurant located within a gas station here, after hearing on Telemundo that community leaders were gathering to condemn the administration's decision. He hoped to get answers on what comes next. At a minimum, he thought, it would make him feel like he was taking action. He hadn't been hungry in days and was unable to think of anything else. Beloren is considering hiring an attorney and is going to write up his local write to his local lawmakers to ask for help. But he's not sure what options are left. The threats he fled back home, he said, remain. He swiped through social media posts on his phone describing Venezuelan professors who had been disappeared or arrested. I simply don't know what to do, Beloren said, looking down at a leather portfolio he had filed with his legal documents. We cannot go back to Venezuela. We'll read a couple of the business columns this week. For Bud Light, woke did mean broke. Bud Light is really, really sorry, said former Anheuser-Busch executive Anson Fredericks. If you didn't notice, its Super Bowl ad was an almost cartoonish celebration of masculine excess, replete with lawnmowers, grills, and coolers filled with ice-cold brewskis. Bud is trying desperately to restore the brand it sabotaged overnight in 2023 with a social media campaign starring a transgender activist, Dylan Mulvaney. In an instant, Bud Light lost its easygoing persona, sacrificed on the altar of progressive politics. Sales collapsed and are now 40% below where they were 2 years ago. The value of Bud's maker, Anheuser-Busch, has been cut by $40 billion. If that seems like a lot for one ad, that's because it was no isolated mistake. Under Michael Doukeris, the CEO Anheuser-Busch installed in 2021, the only question that mattered was, are we doing enough to promote the DEI agenda? Bud Light's marketing chief never made a secret of her progressive politics. Even if they didn't improve sales, inclusive ads at least let Anheuser-Busch brag about what it was doing in its annual ESG reports. Bud Light missed the growing frustration with corporations shoving progressive politics down customers' throats. 2 years later, it has yet to win beer lovers back. The penny is a shiny symbol of waste. Abolishing the cent makes sense financially, said Linda J. Bilmes, and it sends an important message about government. President Trump's order last week to the Treasury Department to stop producing pennies is long overdue. There are over 250 billion pennies currently in circulation, and the U.S. Mint expects to churn out another 4.5 billion in 2025. Where will they end up? Primarily in jars and under couch cushions. But this is no laughing matter. The rising price of metals means that each penny produced costs 3.7 pennies to make. This adds up to $200 million a year. Canada was smart enough to realize this and got rid of its pennies in 2013 when production costs reached 1.6 Canadian cents per coin. Cash transactions were automatically rounded to the nearest 5 cents, with no impact on inflation or daily Canadian life. In America, this is a test of our willingness to confront outdated spending and tackle larger inefficiencies. It may even build momentum for addressing the massive fiscal challenges ahead. Former President Barack Obama once noted that the penny is a metaphor for America's inability to stop doing things that are no longer worth the cost. Retiring it is a simple and sensible move that sends a powerful signal that the culture of endless money is no longer acceptable. We'll read one of the health and science pieces. Brains brimming with plastic. Microplastics are accumulating in our brains and may affect our cognitive health. That's the alarming conclusion of a new study that 52 brain specimens from autopsies, about half from 2016 and half from 2024. Researchers found tiny fragments of plastics in every sample, but concentrations were about 50% higher in the more recent batch, some penetrating deep into the frontal cortex. Earlier samples, dating back to 1997, had the least plastic. Even more alarming, the brains of people who had dementia when they died, exhibited 3 to 5 times more microplastics than normal brains. Although causality there is uncertain, since people with dementia already have weaker blood-brain barriers. Every time we scratch the surface, co-author Matthew Campen from University of New Mexico tells the Washington Post, it uncovers a whole host of, oh, is this worse than we thought? Campen says the increase makes intuitive sense, given that global plastic production doubles every 10 to 15 years. He says more research into the issue is needed, particularly concerning the potential health risks, but that the ubiquity of microplastics makes that difficult. There are no control groups, he says. Everyone is exposed. And on the Talking Points page, NIH, medical research on the chopping block. The Trump administration is feeding the National Institutes of Health into the wood chipper, said Zeynep Tufekci in the New York Times. This agency is the world's largest funder of biomedical research, awarding grants to more than 300,000 researchers at over 2,500 institutions, including the Mayo Clinic and the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas. Such grants have paved the way for new treatments for cancer and HIV, pioneering techniques like IVF, and wonder drugs like Ozempic. But in the name of efficiency, the administration now wants to slash $4 billion from the NIH budget by capping the amount grant recipients receive for indirect cost, general costs like equipment and utility bills, at 15% of their total grant, down from an average of 27%. Under that new ratio, the University of Alabama at Birmingham's medical system, which employs 28,000 people, would lose $70 million a year. A federal judge has temporarily paused the cuts, but if they are allowed to go ahead, universities and academic hospitals will be forced to decide what projects to shut down and which researchers to lay off. This will make Americans sick again. The targets of this cut are bloated university bureaucracies, not critical science research, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. Of the $35 billion in grants the NIH gave out in fiscal 2023, $9 billion went to overheads, with institutions like Harvard and Yale receiving indirect cost of more than 60%. That's why Trump's cost cutter in chief, Elon Musk, rightly called the old system a ripoff. Under the new policy, NIH will be in line with respected private funders of research like Bill Gates Foundation, which caps overheads at 15%. Indirect cost in NIH grants are a perfectly reasonable target for reform, said Yuval Levin in the New Atlantis. But the current rates are mandated by a congressionally approved appropriations rider, so the administration's forced cuts are probably illegal. Once again, the Trump administration has decided to grandstand rather than govern. This anarchy is a feature, not a bug, for Trump and his minions, said Greg Gonzalez in The Nation. They know that even a brief pause in funding can be devastating, because scientific research that relies on continuity, such as the monitoring of cell lines, is wiped out when the lights go off. But that's acceptable for this administration, which regards liberal-dominated universities as the enemy, and cuts in life-saving NIH funding as another weapon to hurt higher education. All of this is going to have deadly and lasting consequences. And a few of the short notes. Candidates for top national security positions in the Trump administration are being asked about their views on the legitimacy of the 2020 election and Trump's Stop the Steal campaign. Two candidates said they were asked to give yes or no answers on whether the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot was an inside job and whether the election was stolen. The candidates who did not give straight yes answers were not hired. Only one state, Maryland, had an outright majority of registered Democratic voters in 2024, down from six states in 2008. Over the same period, Republicans went from having a majority of registrations in one state, Wyoming, to five in 2024. 14 states now have a plurality of registered Republicans, up from seven in 2008. The Trump administration's freeze on foreign aid has interrupted surveillance of the avian flu in 49 countries. Surveillance has also been discontinued for drug-resistant tuberculosis, currently the world's top infectious disease. More than 810,000 cryptocurrency traders have so far lost a combined $2 billion on Trump's meme coin, $Trump, which hit $75 after debuting in mid-January and has since dropped to about $16. The Trump family and its business partners have made about $100 million in trading fees from the venture. On the poll watch, 70% of Americans believe President Trump is doing what he promised, but only 13% approve of his idea about the U.S. taking over Gaza. 58% of adults support allowing transgender men and women to serve in the military, down from 71% in 2019. 78% believe women should continue to serve in combat roles. And we'll get two quotes. First, from Hannah Arendt, "The death of human empathy is one of the earliest and most telling signs of a culture about to fall in barbarism." And Robin Williams says, "Canada is the nice apartment over the meth lab." I'll let you think about that one. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.